time I got there, he understood what was happening. And his so-called bodyguards, they were already in the dust, man. You couldn't even see them no more. And then I believe I hit him with the left first. And he went down. I just pulled him up by his shirt and kept punching him. I hit him, I believe, 7 times. And yeah, he was a mess. He just laid there for about 2-3 minutes. And I got out of there. And but they knew. I went back to my cell, and they just come got me. They knew it was me.
Yeah, they knew it was you. He didn't put up any resistance at all. He just took it.
He tried to block more than anything.
Right, yeah.
I think one time he was trying to punch me because his shoulder dropped a little bit, like he was going to do something because he was getting up, and I hit him down again. But, yeah, that was...
saying anything to him?
He kept saying... I got madder because he said, "Why me? Why me?" I'm thinking, "You son of a bitch! What do you mean, why you?" So I hit him even harder just because I was so angry.
The following podcast is a Carolina Boys production. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Crime and Entertainment. I'm your host, Hollywood Way. Now, today we have Steve Nigg. Steve has spent about 30 years of his life in and out of prisons all across the United States. And he developed a bit of a reputation while serving this time as a chomo hunter. That is, guys that will seek out other inmates that are in jail for child molestation, and he would throw them a beating. Deservedly so, might I add. I've got no sympathy for anybody that does anything and takes the innocence away from a child. And obviously Steve shares that same thought process. The story that he was talking about there, one of many, happened to be the famous spokesperson for Subway at one point in time, Jared Fogle. And as you know, he went to jail for that, and Steve was able to get his hands on him. And I think it was Inglewood Prison. And you'll hear that story and a whole lot more here as we dive in to the life of the chomo hunter himself, Steve Nigg, on Crime and Entertainment. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Crime and Entertainment. I have here probably one of the most interesting guests I've ever had on this show. We've covered a lot of people that's had a lot of different paths in life. Steve has got a very, very interesting path. And you know, the road might've been up and down and curvy at points, but now he's trying to, you know, use his story as a cautionary tale. But he did find himself in some very dark places, but he done some good things, if that makes any sense. And we'll get into what he did here. Please welcome Steve Nigg. Steve, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm good, man. Listen, we've had a few phone conversations and talked for probably a couple of hours before we finally got this set in stone. And I guess right off top, we'll kind of, what you're known for is you're the guy that got a hold to Jared Fogle while he was in the prison system and threw him a beating. Is that correct?
Yes.
But we'll get into your whole entire story here, because there's so much more to you than that. But he wasn't the only one that you did that to. You got a good number of them. You got about, what, 20, 30 of them?
21.
21. So you hit blackjack.
Yes.
All right, so just to let everybody know who you are, what your background is, you know, and kind of why you're here, we're going to start from the beginning of your story, because I think that's important, you know, to start when you're young, and especially if you're a first time guest. So let's start way back from the beginning, man. Tell us a little bit about growing up, what home life was like, mother, father, brother, sister, that sort of thing.
Well, I grew up in Chicago, in different parts of Illinois. My mother and father, very good parents. They were divorced when I was young, but we stayed in touch, everybody. I have 2 brothers, 2 sisters. 1 brother passed away, and we all get along good. We're all raised the same way.
Okay, and this was in the late 60s?
Yes, I was born in 55.
Okay, 55. I mean, now Chicago's known for being a tough city to grow up in. Was it a pretty tough neighborhood?
Some of the places I lived, Southside Chicago was pretty rugged, yes. Because I went through forced busing. It was a big thing in the 60s, and that's the first time that different cultures were shipped to the different schools where they could intermingle.
Right.
So that was a pretty violent era.
Yeah. Now, did that level off some or not while you were there? Was it violence for a while?
It leveled off. Everybody actually got along pretty good after a year or two.
Yeah. Once the merger happens, you know, you have to coexist. Kind of like in jail, you have to learn to coexist. Even if you don't necessarily get along, you have to learn to coexist.
Very true.
Now, at what age would you say you started getting into some of the more criminal aspects?
Oh, it wasn't until I was a young teenager, about 13.
What was the first thing you ever did that was against the law?
Oh, probably just fist fighting.
Fist fighting. So, I mean, was fighting something that you, I mean, obviously we cover in your story, you're pretty good at it. But was it something that brought you a look? Did you enjoy fighting? Was that something that you enjoyed?
I did enjoy it. My dad was a Marine, and so he raised us pretty tough. And because I had two brothers, so we fought a lot.
And were the brothers older?
I got 1 year older, 1 year younger. I was right in the middle.
Oh, okay. Well, I bet that was a Royal Rumble around the house then.
Yes.
He can put a whipping on you, and you can put a whipping on the other one.
Exactly.
I got in my notes here at around, you actually go into a few juvenile halls, one in Chicago and one in Texas.
One in Florida.
One in Florida. Okay.
Pensacola.
Okay.
That was the first one. That was really just for, I was a runaway from Illinois and I got caught in Florida.
Okay. What was the juvenile systems like in the late 60s?
Well, actually in the 69, I was in Pensacola, Florida, and that was a co-ed, actually. The really? Different dorms. The girls stayed in one dorm and we in the other, but we were all in a chow hall together.
Okay.
And it was run extremely strict. If you looked up from you're supposed to eat with your face down. If you looked up at the next table next to you with the girls, you get hit with a ruler in the side of the head.
Ah.
I had lumps all the way around my head.
I was about to say, that's pretty tempting there. You're almost asking them to look when you put them in the <spot. laughs> The girls too. I mean, what, when juvenile hall, you know, was there a lot of violence?
St. Charles Boys School in Illinois, was the most violent. I've been in three or four juvenile centers in Illinois. He started like a camp. And then if you mess up, they put you a higher security, just like in prison. So St. Charles was the maximum security juvenile center.
Okay. And you're around what, 14 years old at this time?
15.
15. Now at 17, you do land in a Cook County in Chicago?
Yeah, Cook County Jail. And they sent me to, that was a really rough place. And from there, they sent me to Vandalia State Work Farm.
What landed you in Cook County?
Aggravated battery.
Now, was this the issue with the cop?
No, that came in 76.
Okay, so you got aggravated battery at 17. That landed you in Cook County. It's here where you first started seeking out chomos.
Yes.
Now, was there a specific reason you did this, or just because you felt it they deserved it? What was kind of the and not that I'm disagreeing with it, because I'm with it 100%. What I'm just trying to figure out is what started, you know, that in you.
Well, the way I was raised was to protect people who couldn't protect themselves.
Right.
So I've always hated bullies.
Right.
I see a big guy picking a little guy, I would jump in. Mm-hmm. And you just escalated from there. Once I went to, like in Vandalia, I went to the hole there for a fight because I found this guy was in there for molesting a kid. So I called him alone, and I just beat the hell out of him, and then he ratted me off. So I went to the shoot. That was the first child molester that I ever beat.
How long were you in the shoe for that particular time?
30 days, which is average.
Was that the first time you've been in the shoe?
In an adult?
Yeah.
Yes.
What is it like in there, your first time being in the shoe? For people that don't know, that's a special housing. I mean, it's basically solitary, right?
Yes.
I mean, what is that like? What goes through your mind? I mean, what do you have to do to make it out of that mentally? Because it's not necessarily physically grueling. It's got to be mentally grueling, right?
Mentally, it is. Being that young, I didn't handle it very well. It definitely caused psychological problems. Mm-hmm. Back then, they wouldn't even give you books.
Right.
You just said, now you get as many books as you want because they try to keep your mind occupied because they found out it wasn't working, trying to drive us insane.
Mm-hmm.
And it affected me all through the rest of my life.
No, I can believe it. I mean, I was never in solitary the short time I was, you know, in a detention center. But I can't imagine being in somewhere I was totally alone. Like, it would just have to wear on your mind and beat you down mentally. And as your story unfolds, that you spent a lot more time than, you know, a month in the hole. And I can't imagine how you made it through that. But we'll get into that here. When you get out of that place, you head down to Arizona. You left Illinois and headed down to Arizona.
Yes. 1976. In between these times, I'd be in Cook County Jail or the House of Corrections in Chicago. And I had a couple of court dates to go to, one for assault and battery. And I knew I was going to get time for it. Mm-hmm. So a friend of mine hit the road and went to Arizona.
Okay. Now, is any point in here, like, are you not scared of going back to jail? Are you set on, like, you know, just trying to survive by any means necessary? Do you want to get on a straightened path? Where's your mindset at this point? Because you've been through a lot here to only be around, you know, a little over 17 years of age.
Prison doing time was never a deterrent for me because it never bothered me.
Okay.
So, unfortunately, I wish it did.
Right.
But it never did.
And I've heard that from some people that I've interviewed, you know, doing time just wasn't a big thing for them. I've heard some guys say that. One guy told me he was a pretty prolific drug kingpin out of Detroit. And he told me when he finally got arrested, he had to do, I think he had 10 years, but he said, I looked at it as a break.
True.
And it was an interesting way he put it. Cause he was like, he said, you think about this. He said, you're on the street. He said, you got to worry about your enemies. You got to worry about the police. He said, you got to worry about your friends because that's always the guy under you wanting to take your spot. He said, you've always worrying. He said, once I got arrested and I had to go in there, he said, my time was like a catwalk.
Well, see, I think prison is the same way. I don't really agree with the guys that much because prison, you got to watch your back more.
Right.
The police are the guards. You got to watch them all the time.
Right.
So I think it's
just the same.
Yeah. But a lot of people, too, they become institutionalized.
Yes.
I've never been institutionalized.
Yeah.
I had to fight it off a few times, but I know some may have.
Now, when you went to Arizona, you kind of told me in a conversation that we had, you just kind of went on like a 2-week rampage. And there was an incident with a cop that happened that landed you in jail for, at this point in time, your longest stretch. Kind of tell us a little bit about the incident with the cop and how that came to be.
Yes, I was, we just did an armed robbery, me and my partner. It was about the third or fourth armed robbery we did in 3 or 4 days. And every time we did an armed robbery, we had to steal another car. So we were waiting to steal a car This is Halloween, 1976. Mm-hmm. And we were in the back of the apartment complex, and a police officer stepped in. Somebody called about a suspicious character. And when he walked in, we had no choice. So we pulled our guns on him. And then I handcuffed him to a shopping cart, took his leather coat. It was cool. And then we drove away in his police car. And
drove away in the police car?
Yeah, we had no other car now. We had to take his. And I think I told you, I really felt bad later down the line. I wouldn't think this would really happen to a police officer, because if you carry a gun, you have to expect trouble.
Yes.
Cop, soldier, whatever. If you got a gun, you got to be prepared.
Oh, yeah.
And he just wasn't ready for this dramatic experience. And he ended up in a mental institution, quit the police force, and it ruined his whole life. And I feel very bad about that when I found out many years later that this happened to him.
And part of that, I know it, when people think kidnapping, I think movies and whatnot, they have you kind of picturing you taking somebody and holding them for ransom. But yes, kidnapping can be as simple as you holding someone with a gun and telling them to move from one spot to the next, because you're making them move by force somewhere they don't willingly want to go. It's very vague. And did they try to hit you with a kidnapping charge with this?
I was charged just for that police officer incident. I was charged with aggravated battery with a deadly weapon, car theft, and kidnapping.
Wow. What about other, did they get you for any of the robberies that you were doing?
Well, we ended up making somewhat of a deal. They dropped the kidnapping, everything with the police officer, because that would have gave me probably 30 to 50 years.
I was about to say, anything with a police officer, they're gonna hammer your ass for that.
Exactly. So they end up convicting me of 3 armed robberies, and I received 15 to 30 years.
Okay. Now, did you have a public defender?
Yes.
Okay. Now, and everybody knows that the public defender, and I'm not bashing all public defenders. Some of them I do think do a great job, but by and large, their job is to get a conviction, to get you in, get you out, and you know, speed the court process along. Very seldom will you get one that's trying to fight, you know, to get you the least amount of time possible. It's more of an in and out process.
It is.
And I'm assuming at that point, you just didn't really have the financial means to go after like a paid lawyer to help you out.
Correct.
Okay. So you're, what age were you right here?
I just turned 21.
And you're getting 15 to 30?
Yes.
Did that faze you at all here in 15 to 30 years?
No.
Wow. That's,
I expected it, of course. I didn't expect that much time. I thought I might get lucky and maybe get a 10 bid, but
now I know sentencing guidelines and stuff have changed a lot throughout the years. I know depending on certain, you know, where you get in, you have to do X amount of time. Was there a rule at, you know, at that point in time about how much that time you had to do? Did you have to do at least the 15? Did you have to do 75% of that? What was the sentencing guidelines?
Well, if I wouldn't have lost any good time, I would have been out, I think, 11 years.
Okay.
But I lost every day a good time.
So it's on the good time, you're going to do at least 15, and they could keep you in there up to 30. Is that basically how it is?
No, back then it was, you do one day, you get 2 days.
Oh, really?
That's why the judge gave me 15 to 30 instead of like 15 to 20. I would have got out really early, but they gave me 15 to 30 before I'd have to do it.
Oh, okay. All right. All right. I understand now. Now the first prison you went to was Arizona, Florence Prison.
Yes.
That's obviously, I'm pretty sure, the toughest prison you've been to at this point, right?
Definitely.
What are you thinking going in here? What's your mindset?
I didn't really think too much of it because I had done so many years of juvenile time, so much county time, Vandalia State Farm. So I was prepared for it already. So it wasn't bothering me.
So was your mindset though, as far as like, you know, keep to myself, or was it click up, you know, find someone to, or a gang or whatever to hook up with? What was that mode of thinking?
Well, I didn't know much about cliques until I got there. Right. 'Cause the other places I was in, there wasn't prison gangs.
Right.
So this is the first time where I found out just about everybody clicked up with Aryan Brotherhood for the white people, the Mexican Mafia for the Mexicans. The blacks had Mau Mau's organization, and then they had their Black Panther Muslim organization. Mm-hmm. So everybody was pretty well clicked up.
Okay. Now, you meet an individual in prison that you've shared some stories about, and I've got some pictures that I'm going to put up in post when we're talking about, but he went by the name Banzai.
Yes.
How long were you in before you met him?
Just a couple weeks. His name is Robert Vickers, but if you called him Robert Vickers, he would stab you. You had to call him Banzai. Yeah. And he did stab one guy who did call him by his name. So everybody after that called him Banzai.
Well, we'll go with Banzai here to be safe. You guys kind of click up together and you both decide to join the Aryan Brotherhood.
Yes. Well, we were approached. Mm-hmm. Everybody gets approached and you become a prospect usually for 6 months. And
how was that approach? Walk us through that approach. I mean, is it, you know, what was their pitch to join?
Well, the Aryan Brotherhood was just starting when Banzai and me got there, probably a month or two. So there wasn't even many members in.
Okay.
So they were looking to recruit, and they always go for the young guys.
Right.
And first thing they do is check your paperwork, make sure you're not a rat, chomo, have anything bad on your record. And then they just ask you if you want a prospect here. Said an easy way out, which is completely false.
Right.
And I was gung-ho for anything then. I'm doing 15 to 30 at 21. To me, that's life. I never thought that I was going to get out anyway.
Right.
So I became a prospect with Banzai. And as I told you, in order to get in, it's called getting your bones, making your bones. Mm-hmm. You have to go on a hit.
Now, who did they have somebody in mind? I'm assuming this was a rival. Was it a member of the Black Gang, the Mexican Mafia? Who'd they have you go after?
Usually a snitch.
Okay.
Or very seldom you're going to find a child molester in a maximum security prison setting.
Right.
Because the administration knew he was going to get hit, so they put him in protective custody. They had one cell block just for protective custody.
Okay. Now, you both get tasked with this. I'm assuming this is different individuals that you got. You got one and he's got something else.
Yes.
Somebody else. How does yours go down?
Mine was in a chow hall. And it was a snitch. And I ended up stabbing him, I think, 6 times.
With a shiv?
Yeah. Yes. And he lived and testified against me. There was another guy who was supposed to be with me. He's supposed to get his bones too. They sent two to make sure if he gets past one, the other one gets him. And
right.
Because you want him dead.
Right.
But the other guy didn't. He dropped his shank and ran. So he got killed. He got killed for that, actually.
Yeah, I can imagine that. Probably that's not going to look too good in the initiation process. How did you make your shiv?
They were made in, they had a metal shop. So we had them made in the metal shop. And then we had to smuggle them in. That wasn't easy. Mm-hmm. Usually we have, I don't want to sound gross or nothing, but we have there's a couple of gay guys.
Yeah.
You probably heard this before down the line. In fact, on one of your podcasts, I heard
Easter Stash.
Yeah.
Michael Thompson. Yeah. I think I've heard it even termed suitcasing, but I think when Michael was talking about it, Michael Thompson, he said it was the term he used was Keister Stash.
Keister Stash, when we used to.
Yeah. So whatever, I mean, by any means necessary, you got to get him in there. You know, when we were talking, I don't know if you heard that part of the interview, but he was saying that they were able to fight with like buck knives in the prison they were in because he was using Charles Manson's followers, the women that were coming in to visit him, and they would have them, then get them out somewhere during the visit, pass them to Charlie, and Charlie would give them to him. So the Aaron Brotherhood was actually in there able to fight with buck knives.
That was, I heard that, yes. Very few, it happened in the visit room a few times, a woman would insert it in her vagina, and that was, it was pretty rare. Because most of the guys just had the woman put, you know, balloons in there and get the drugs in.
Now, you said you got him six times, but he lived and testified against you.
He did, but this time I had my brother got me a really good lawyer, and we went to street trial, and I got an acquittal.
What is that?
To my surprise. Pardon me?
What is street trial? What is that?
The street court.
That's in prison? That's like a
court. Well, I got found guilty in prison. Prison court, but then he took me out to the streets.
Oh, okay.
And I got indicted, and then I went to trial. That's what I meant by street trial.
Okay, all right. And then you were found not guilty?
By a jury of 12, yes.
Wow.
I know.
Was it a unanimous or a hung jury, or what was it?
No, unanimous.
Wow.
Even when the guy testified against me.
So he must not have been a very believable witness anyway.
He was... He got on the stand and he changed his story too many times. So the jury thought he was lying.
Yeah.
But he really wasn't. Because the first interview was when he first got stabbed. He said, "Who did this?" And he said, "My name."
Right.
And then in the hospital, when he was recovering, he made a different story. But his mind was so screwed up because when you get stabbed, you're not thinking rationally. You're not seeing things really clear.
Right.
So his story was different, but he wasn't lying.
Right. Okay. Because I was actually a little reluctant to talk about that story, but hearing that you actually went to court and you beat it, you don't have anything to fear with that due to the double jeopardy law.
Right. That's the only reason I would talk about it.
Right. Because when you were talking about it, I was like, I don't know if I should talk about that because I don't think I knew the details that you went to court about it. You just said you beat it. So I didn't know, maybe it just didn't go to trial. Maybe you didn't want to testify. So I said, I might leave that out. But that's interesting that you went and beat it. I mean, I'm glad you beat it. But Banzai didn't have that same luck.
No, Banzai, he was 20. I was 21. When we were the soldiers. We had no rank, and we were both wild. The really sad part is he was only doing, I think it was 5 to 7 years or 7 to 10 years. Sure. That's all he had. He would have been out with good time. He would have been out in 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. And then he got his first stabbing. He got 20 years.
20 years.
20 years added on. And after that, he just didn't care, and we were all in lockup together in the hole, and it was so crowded, you had to give everybody a cell partner. And he didn't like his cell partner, Frank was his name. So Banzai killed him. He was on the top bunk, and Banzai put a noose around him and choked him to death. Then he stabbed him a couple times and killed him. He was about 4 cells down from me. So we heard everything, but the COs didn't. But when they made their counts, you got to stand up for count.
Yeah.
And Banzai looked at the CO there and said, "Get this dead guy out of my cell." And the CO said, "Quit messing around, Banzai." They even called him Banzai. And Banzai was smoking a big stogie, and he took the stogie and he put it right in Frank's eye. Just burned his eyeball out. But he's dead, but still.
Right.
And that CO had to quit. He couldn't. He quit that day. He never came back.
Holy
and Banzai got the death penalty for that. And then he still didn't slow down. Now he's on death row. And this baby raper, he was in a wheelchair. And for some reason, he let Banzai be the porter. So we went and cleaned and swept and mopped.
Right.
And he got some flammable solution. And the guy was in a wheelchair. And Banzai squirted on him and lit him on fire.
Holy
right there. And he burned and screamed and burned to death.
He got
the death penalty again.
And he done this while he was on death row.
Yes.
I was about to say, because I think at one point in time, there was a serial killer actually here from the South Carolina area where I'm from. His name was Pee Wee Gaskins. And they said that at least at that time or around that time, he was one of the only people to ever kill somebody successfully on death row. He managed to somehow hook a bomb to a radiator. I don't know. I mean, obviously it had to be some sort of homemade fixture, but he right. hooked it to the radio, give the guy the radio. He was in the next cell. And when the guy turned the radio, he said, "You got to put it up to your ear. You know, I'll turn it on." When he put it up to his ear, it blew him up. And the whole thing was facilitated from outside the prison because that guy that got the bomb had killed someone's mother. And so that guy had sent Pee-wee or was taking care of Pee-wee's people on the outside for him to do it. And that was while he was on death row. He killed a bunch of people, man. Really short dude. But I mean, he killed a lot of people.
Wow.
Yeah. There's a book and I actually have it, but it's really hard to find because it was only out for a certain amount of time. Then it got taken out of circulation. His daughter, I think, or sister, somebody put it back in circulation for like a year and then it was gone again. And I've seen these books go anywhere from $200 to up towards $1,000. Like they're really hard to find, but it's probably the most brutal book I've ever read. And I don't know if I've even had anyone on the podcast yet that comes close to some of the stuff that this man did. And this was all his autobiography, but I mean, he had no limitations to his brutality.
Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy. So, obviously if he gets in death row, you're not seeing much of him at this point, right?
No, at one time there was everybody who was in a gang was, they were locking everybody up just for being affiliated and trying to transfer people. So they ran out of room. So and it wasn't that many people on death row. So they put us, the rest of us on death row. So I got to meet all kinds of guys on death row, like the Tysons. I don't know if you're familiar with the Tysons, but they broke out of Arizona prison and killed all those people, a 6-month-old baby. It was just horrible.
Wow.
The father did that, but the kids broke him out. So they killed the father. So the kids ended up on death row.
Jesus.
Yeah. So we got to meet everybody on death row.
And there's a period of time here where the AB actually has like an internal war.
Yes, that started because we're all in the hole now for making our bones. And the new guys coming up in the AB decided to change the rules that you don't have to make a hit to right. get in. And we argued about that. And that's what started the war. And what really started after that, one of the guys, we were in cell block 3, and this guy, he's dead now, Stoney, we call him. He got hold of a gun and went by 4 cells and shot 4 other ABs, killing one.
Okay. Now, and at one point during this war, you wind up in the hole for about 2 years?
Well, after I got that stabbing incident, That cost me 2 years in the hole. Yeah.
Okay. So even though you were found not guilty, you still got 2 years in the hole.
Right. Because the prison kangaroo court found me guilty.
Okay. What is 2 years in the hole like?
I still wasn't ready for it because I was still too young. So my mind wasn't really set for it. But I was a little bit more occupied then because for the stabbing, I did like 30 days in solitary confinement. And then they put you in a cell and they just give you your property. And they just tell you, we'll come back in a couple of years. So you got, you know, a lot of times you have a TV even. So that helped a lot.
Oh, but yeah,
you're still 23 hours. You're only out of your cell 3 hours a week.
Damn, a week.
Yeah, so that caught up with us after a while. And I act up and go back to the isolation cell for 30 days just to get a break. I just purposely do something.
Yeah, wow. Now you're out of the hole there after this 2 year period. You're out and you get shot with a 22?
Yes, I when they would, that side AB would come to the hole, that's where we would get them. And when they finally let some of us out of the hole, that's when the other side would make their attack. So I was out for, I was only out of the hole for, I think, 4 or 5 days. And this guy, I knew he had a beef with him already. So I tried to go shanks up with him. And I thought maybe he would, because he would lose face in front of his people, his side AV, because he didn't have the guts to do it. And I was right. He didn't have the guts to do it. So he just jumped in front of my cell and shot me twice with a 22 gun.
Is that the first time you'd ever been shot?
Yes. I've been stabbed before, but
what'd that feel like?
On the streets, but that was the first time I was shot.
What'd that feel like?
Stabbing hurts more. When I was, I think I was 12 years old, I was in Chicago Heights. I got stabbed when I was 12, and that was painful. But getting shot was just a little burn. Mm-hmm. I still got one bullet in me from that one.
Okay. Now, you go back to the hole after that?
Back to the hole for about 2 more years, because you usually just stay 2 years to you. That's the average, I guess. And then I got out of the shoe again, and the war is still going on. We're still hitting each other. I caught a conspiracy to a murder case in between here, but they didn't have enough proof, so they couldn't take me to street trial, street court. So I got out of that one. And then I got out. Again, I was only out for 4 or 5 days, and I was on the athletic field. And 3 guys surrounded me and stabbed me 8 times.
Damn. How close were you to death?
That was the closest I've ever been, because I got hit with an ice pick all the way through my stomach. So I'm trying to hold my intestines in with my thumb. And I got hit with both lungs. One lung collapsed and one was punctured, so I couldn't. Very little breath. I could hardly breathe. And a couple times in the chest. And I was a mess that time.
Wow.
They had to take me by helicopter to the, first they took me to just a little uptown Florence hospital. They couldn't do nothing. And they put me on a helicopter.
Now, with the AB feuding like they were, you know, a lot of times when a gang is having an internal feud, that's the best time to take advantage if you're a rival gang.
Yes.
Did that happen while you guys were having the internal beef? Did anybody else try to take advantage of that?
Not really, because the Mexican Mafia were in the same predicament. They were killing each other left and right, and they were the first gang there. That's why the Aryan Brotherhood and the Mau Maus and everybody organized, because they were taking over and doing anything they wanted. When the white guys came in, Black guys came in, they were getting them to pay protection, making their people smuggle dope in for them, right. And all this. That's why the other gangs originated. But then they started, Mexican Mafia killing each other, so they didn't mess with us. Now, we didn't want to mess with them too much, and vice versa, because we knew it would just be a bloodbath and nobody would win.
Right. There's a period of time where you actually go on a hunger strike.
That's when, after I got stabbed, and because of just being AB, and they obviously didn't know how violent I am by now from my prison experiences, plus my charges while I was there. And they just said, this time you're not getting out. And I, at that time, I still had like 9 or 10 years left. Mm-hmm. I'm not about to stay in the hole for that long. So I went on a 54-day hunger strike.
What was the philosophy behind that, and how did that affect you?
Well, they put me back in the hole, of course, and they decided that I was too disruptive. And by this time, I had a little bit more rank in the Aryan Brotherhood, so I had more influence. And they knew, how, of course, by now how violent I am, or can be if I'm pushed or if I have to do something.
Right.
So they just said, I think I had 9 or 10 years left, and they weren't ever going to let me out of the hole. So I went on a hunger strike, which lasted 54 days. I went from like 190 pounds to 112. And when they finally decided I was for real, they knew I was going to die. And I was on the news every day. I had a good lawyer, right. the same lawyer who beat the stabbing beef for me. Mm-hmm. And so with the publicity and seeing that I was just about dead, they knew they had to do something with me. And they knew I wasn't going to stop till I died. And
how close do you think you were to death?
Oh, very close. All my vitals were, the nurse told him he's going to die, because the nurse came every day and took my blood pressure and this and that. And she was real nice. She was trying to get me off it, but I was committed now. I wouldn't do it. So out of the blue, they cuffed me and stuffed me, and boom, I woke up in Kansas, Lansing, Kansas State Prison.
So you didn't even know you were moved?
No, I didn't know where I was going. They just threw me on a plane, and there it was.
What did, how long did it take you to put, because you're a pretty big guy. How long did it take you to put the weight back on?
About 6 months, because I started lifting weights and, eating right and all that. So, I made a full recovery from it.
How hard is it if you're in, I realize you got a lot of time to work out, but how hard is it to eat right in prison? Cause it's not like you're getting served gourmet meals with the best of ingredients there. How hard is it to maintain a good diet while you're in prison?
Well, you can't, unless you know, the big thing about prison is tuna and mackerel.
Right.
Cause in order to lift weights and get any muscle, you have to eat a lot of protein.
Right.
And, back in the state, when I was doing the state prison time, it wasn't bad because at that time you could get a powdered protein.
Okay.
So it wasn't bad. In the Fed system now, when I went to the Fed system, it was a whole different thing. You had to eat like 4, 5, 6 tunas every day.
Gee. So you wake up, you're in Kansas and Lansing State Prison. What did you, did you kind of ask, like, how the hell did I get here? What was the, what was the deal? What was your mindset?
I didn't even ask. I was glad to be there.
Right.
I'm out of the hole now. The hunger strike's over. And first I was in the hole there until they got to know me and see how I was acting. And not for long, maybe 20 days or something. And then they let me in general population.
Okay. Now, did you start a chapter of the AB there?
Yes, that's where I kind of came into my own in that prison, because I got all this knowledge and from being in prison so long and going through all I did in Arizona prison. And this wasn't near as a violent prison is Florence, Arizona. But it was wasn't all clicked up, but it was enough where there was still a lot of drama, and a lot of it was on the white people. So I started a chapter of the Aryan Brotherhood, and a friend of mine from Arizona prison, who I don't want to mention because he's still alive, he was transferred some months later to the same prison as me in Kansas. So we started a chapter there, very small chapter, and because I didn't make the same mistakes that they did in Arizona, because it was a power struggle there. Mm-hmm. You know, just four or five guys running the whole AB, ordering hits, and some of them were unnecessary. But that's what happens when you give people power, they abuse it.
Right.
I think the saying is, power corrupts.
Absolute power corrupts.
Absolutely. Yep. And that's what it did.
Yeah. And that doesn't matter if you're a street gang, if you're a cop, if you're the president. I mean, that's true in every facet, in every level, in every organization.
I agree totally. It's been proven so much. Yeah. So I made a council. There was like six guys. And when we made the decision to make a hit or whatever had to be done, we voted on it. So it wasn't just a couple of guys on a power struggle doing this. Because I didn't want, and I was trying to get away from all that now.
Right.
But because of the structure of the prison, I kind of had to get a chapter going. And there was maybe three or four hits, and then it stopped.
And then, and correct me if I'm wrong here, and I'm going off like, you know, some of the mob guys, the former mob guys that we've interviewed, murder was a part of the business. But it wasn't always the go-to, because when you do that, obviously it brings heat, it brings cops, it brings investigation. I'm assuming it's similar to that in prison. If something like that happens, there's a lockdown, nobody's able to move freely. I'm sure you guys are earning in different ways in there. That probably comes to a halt. So do you only resort to that when absolutely necessary, when there's no other choice, or how open is that to green light someone?
Well, in Kansas prison, it was very difficult because we didn't want no violence. That's why I organized it, to stop the violence. Because mm-hmm. after we organized, they knew not to mess with us. At least the white people there in the AB, they didn't. And okay. You know, the blacks had their gang there too, and nobody messed with them, because they knew if you mess with one gang member, you got them all. So that's the, in Kansas prison, it worked. And it stopped a lot of the violence there.
Okay. That makes sense. You actually start selling shirts out of this prison. How does this come about?
Yeah. I was just so glad to be out of the most violent prison at that time in the United States of America.
Yeah.
There's books written on that era that you can still get. If you get on Amazon, you can still get them. But I was trying to get out of the violence, and I started a kind of an organization after the AB, because I ran into this one guy that was with us, and he told me a story about him being molested, and he wanted to do something about it, and he knew my reputation about child molesters, and so we just started having events, and they had a printing shop at Kansas State Prison. So I had shirts made up, child prevention shirts. And I hooked up with an organization on the street, and they helped us. I would organize events like a weightlifting contest, a 10K race, anything like that, and we would make money and send it to the organization on the street, the child abuse organization.
Right.
And we only make like $400-$600 here and there, but you know, it was just that we were doing something and trying to bring awareness.
So that was, I mean, that's kind of always been your mantra, you know, you survive in prison the best way you can, but, you know, still that protection of the kids, because I think that's really the soft spot. You know, it's bad enough when it happens to an adult, but yes, because, you know, even adults, you know, somewhat to a certain degree have the ability to fight it off, or, you know, maybe the ability to do things about it, maybe the knowledge to go to the police or whatever they need to do. But a kid doesn't have that. And a lot of times they're, you know, scared to come forward because they're scared nobody will believe them. And, you know, and sometimes it happens so much that they think it's normal.
And yes,
it's really sad to think about when you do that to a kid, you ruin their whole rest of their life.
They never get over it. Like, I believe it was Michael Thompson said, it's really psychological murder.
Yeah.
That I don't care how much therapy you get. I know dozens and dozens and dozens of people that are molested, and they still not completely over it, because it's not as if you could forget what happened to you. But no, so many people are dealing with it and able to survive. But there's more that can't even have a normal life ever.
And he detailed, like, sometimes at night in the prison, like, you could hear that happening to other inmates.
Yes. Yes. That is often anymore. More in Florence, like in Kansas, it wasn't running rampant like that.
Okay. Now, you're doing good things here. I mean, the best you can, you know, you're in prison, you're making the best of it here. Why did you have to move this one? And if no particular reason, were you also getting into fights when you were seeking out chomos in this prison?
I couldn't find many, because they wouldn't let them in general population. Once in a while, one would get by, and as soon as I found him, that was it.
Yeah.
He was off the yard.
So how long were you total here at Kansas?
Well, I was in Arizona prison, Florence, 5.5 years when they transferred me. And I was in Kansas prison 5.5 years when they finally decided, because I had such a following and I got along with all the other cultures, like the Black gang, Mexican gang, I got along with everybody. And mainly because they saw that I wasn't looking for trouble.
Right.
That I organized the AB there to stop the violence.
Yeah.
Where in Arizona, it was just the opposite. That was created for violence.
Yeah.
And I had too many people liking me. I was too popular. And they decided they needed to get rid of me, because now we all got along so good, all the gangs, that we were going against the guards.
Right. And they're thinking that you could lead a revolution here.
Yes. And it's one thing in prison that the prison administration always does since the beginning of time of prisons to this very day, and it will never change. The administration does everything they can to make the cultures or the races clash.
Right.
Because they need that, because if they don't, and we all get together, we're going to be against them.
Yeah.
So I understand why they're doing that. You're still not right, but they're caused killings before.
And when you have someone that can unblur those lines and bring people together for a common, you know, at least foresight, you know, in prison or not, for a common good, that is dangerous. That is very dangerous for the prison system.
Yes, it is.
And so where did they send you?
Well, unfortunately, they had to send me back where I came from.
Ah.
So there I am back in Arizona. And while I was gone, they built a whole prison, SMU, they called it, Special Management Unit, the most locked-down prison I've ever seen. And I was there for 20 months. And they weren't going to transfer me. Won't transfer me in the morning. Won't do nothing. And then they said the same thing. You're staying here till you get out. So So I said, oh, and then the lieutenant even said, don't even try a hunger strike again, because it won't work. So I went on hunger strike.
How long was this one?
This one was for 30 days, but it was so strict. I did nothing but drink water. In the last couple of days, I even quit water. And I was actually closer to death this time than the first hunger strike. And they found, again, they said, he's not going to stop. He's going to die. We can't afford the bad publicity. So there I am, cut and stuffed, and I end up in Wyoming State Prison, Rawlins.
Wow, that's got to be in the middle of nowhere.
It was. It was a small prison. It's only like 300-something people. It's closed now, but...
But you got to be nearing the end of your stretch here, though, right?
I only got like a year left.
Okay. Was there, I mean, were you going to make, did you, were you able to get parole? Were you going to get out early? What was the ending of that?
Well, I lost all my good time.
Okay.
So I ended up maxing my sentence out. They couldn't keep me a day longer.
Okay.
But while I was in Wyoming, all I did was eat right, lifted weights. I was big when I got out. And no trouble. I didn't get one incident report while I was there. And by this time, though, you know, when I started out, I was 21.
Right.
And then when I went to Kansas prison.
Around 35 here.
Yeah. Now, Wyoming time, I'm 32.
Okay.
30. I was in Kansas prison. I was 27. And they transferred back to Arizona 2 years. Time I got to Wyoming, I was a 33.
Okay.
So by that time, I calmed myself down. I've been through it all now, all these prisons. And I'm trying to get away from violence and teach other people to get away from violence. It was a slow changing process.
Mm-hmm.
But I changed a lot. And having the Little Kids Foundation, Kansas prison, really helped me, and I kept it in my mind all the time to try to keep something like that going, helping with kids. And Wyoming ended up paroling me, and I went to my brother Jim in sister-in-law Virginia, and that was in 1990. Now I'm 34.
Okay, so you get out there in 1990. What is different? You've been in there roughly 15 years. What was the biggest adjustment to society for you at that point in time?
Smell. I couldn't smell it. Stuff would nauseate me. Gas, a car. I never saw carpet for all those years. So carpet smelled horrible to me because I'm used to cement, steel. Yeah. That was it. So the smell thing was crazy. And, real food was, of course, the biggest thing. Anybody's going to tell you that when you get out. And so, yeah, it was great.
What was your mindset like here? Was it still, you know, obviously you're probably not dying to go back in there. Were you wanting to try to go more on a straightened path, or what was your mindset?
Yes, I've been through enough. I've had enough punishment on me. I've suffered enough, it was all bad suffering. It wasn't good suffering. You know, some suffering is actually good, but this is all bad suffering, except for organizing that little child thing I did in Kansas. Other than that, it was just bad time. All that time in the hole, years and years. I know my head's a little screwed up because of it now, and it was then. But I mean, it's a lot better now than it was. Right. But I just wanted a smooth track.
Right. Now, you wind up moving to help your father run his business.
No, he had open heart surgery, and his wife, my stepmother, developed cancer. So I went out to take care of them, and. My stepmom, she ended up dying from the cancer.
Okay.
So, and her last words to me were, promise me you won't leave until your father dies. You know, here's a woman dying and she's worried about her husband, my dad. I thought that was really something.
Yeah, that's a connection right there.
Yeah, so I couldn't say no.
Right.
And my father wasn't doing that great. I wasn't going to really leave anyway. And so I stayed and helped him with his business. And we were in a vending business. We had pool tables, dart machines, gambling machines, and bars. So we did real good.
Now, I mean, some of that, at least some stories that I've heard, we had a guy on recently that he was basically, he would go around and empty out all those machines. Of course, by this time it's illegal. So it's not exactly in the best of areas and the best of crowds. I don't know what the landscape was here, you know, in 2010, were these illegal poker machines that y'all had, or were they above board?
It was illegal.
Okay.
Yeah. The whole thing was illegal.
But they brought in good money, though.
They brought in excellent money. I was doing so good. I had my own house almost paid. I had all kinds of toys. I had so many toys. I built a garage that was bigger than my house. I had 110 acres of land, wooded. It was just beautiful. I had it made.
Wow. Any trouble doing these vending machines? Because you don't really get in trouble again until much later. I mean, you're clean for, what, almost 15 years?
20.
20, yeah.
So yeah, I got out in 90, didn't go back into 2010.
Okay, so yeah, you got a good stretch in there, 20 years, but you don't get in any trouble.
None. Well, I got a couple of fist fights in the bars. Because I was in the bars all the time with the machines, and so I got a drunk driving ticket, a couple of minor things like that.
Yeah, nothing substantial to send you back to, you know.
No, right. Never.
Any close calls with the Joker or the poker machines?
You got me in the end there. They were changing the laws on them, and my father put it in my name, and then for when he died, it was all set that I would have it. But we ended up actually selling it just a year before he passed. But IRS nailed me. They nailed me good for like, I forget what it was, 200 something thousand. But the thing is, I went to prison, so I didn't have to pay it.
Oh, well, that's still lining, I guess.
Right.
My stepdad was recently involved in a pinch where a lot of guys had some illegal machines, and they had them on their property, and they would only let people they know, you know, come on the property and play. But, you know, as soon as somebody gets jammed up with something, first thing they do is, well, I know a place where you can go to do poker machines. I can tell you all about it. And him and a bunch of guys, you know, they had to pay some fines. It wasn't too terrible. I mean, the way I see it, you know, you're not hurting anybody. People are going to gamble on something, and you can't watch. I don't know if you're a football fan or not, but I mean, like, you can't watch a game in nowadays without seeing two or three different betting commercials or betting sites to go on. And probably 5 years ago, the NFL was totally against gambling. It was nothing they wanted to be affiliated with. And now, you know, there's 20 DraftKings or FanDuels or BetMGMs commercials every 2 minutes. It's totally changed. When they see how much money it's bringing in, it's okay. And that's what I talked to a lot of these mob guys about. They're furious because they're like, everything that we did is now okay. You know, we ran numbers. We made a lot of money running numbers. You have the lottery now. You know, we were doing bookmaking. We were taking bets. Now bookmaking is legal in most places. Or if it's not legal in your state, you can go online and do an offshore site. Everybody can do it right from their cell phone. So it's like all the ideas that they had that made them millions of dollars over the years, it's like the government finally wised up and was like, oh, we should do this. And they just legalize them. That's okay.
Right. They're actually legal in Wisconsin now.
Really?
Yeah, they made it legal.
I know they had some for a period of time here in South Carolina where it's like they were online gambling machines. So that was a workaround, and you got credits. You didn't get cash, but the credits could then be turned in for cash. It was a weird process, but it was a workaround. And I know a guy that made a killing for a period of time. He rented out a room. He packed it full of machines, and he said, I know this isn't going to last. He said, so I'm month leasing the building, and I'm leasing the machines. He said, I'm going to ride it until they put a stop to it. And it lasted about 6 months, but he made a killing. Like, because those things, I mean, they're designed, you know, you collected off of them. They're only going to pay out so much. They're going to take in a whole hell of a lot more than they pay out.
Right. You could set the machine to pay out what you want.
Right. So right. You're not going to lose money. There's no way you can lose money unless you lose the machine or the cops break it and smash it. You're not going to lose money if that machine's operational.
Definitely.
Now you have a situation that's really screwed up to where you re-violate, and it had to do ultimately, and we're sorry for this, but your father passing away. Tell us a little bit about the situation.
Well, my father passed away. He was a gun dealer, a gun collector. He had about 150 beautiful pieces, and he asked me to sell them and split the money with my brothers and sisters. And now he's remarried. He married this woman, Joyce, and he just married her at the end of his life before she could get his Social Security and his military benefits. And he left her a nice hunk of money, land, and two houses my dad had. He wanted me to sell them both and split the money between my brothers, sisters, and Joyce. So she had a nice hunk of money coming, but she wanted everything. So what ended up happening was I touched the guns because I moved them out of the house because I knew it was a felon. And I had a police officer there letting him know what I was doing. And he said, okay, go ahead and do it. So we relayed all the guns out and moved them to a friend's house, but I touched them. So that's felon in possession of a firearm. And then they got a private investigator to look me up and saw me selling guns. I sold him two. And so they just had all this evidence where they could prove that I touched the gun. I could have them, I could sell them, but I just couldn't touch them. But I touched them, and so they charged me with, she got a lawyer and trying to fight everything, trying to get all the money. And in so doing, I was charged with felon in possession of a firearm because I touched it, wasn't using crime or nothing. And I got 15 years for that. Mm.
And the judge didn't even want to give you the 15.
I had a good judge. I really did. He even asked the prosecutor, because he gave me armed career criminal. Right. So they had to go back to 1976, where those armed robberies I told you I did.
Yeah.
And the cop thing, they used that against me, saying 1976, he did this, so he's an armed career criminal. And they had a mandatory minimum sentence. And it was 15 years. So I end up doing 15 years twice for the same crime, really.
Mm-hmm. And I think Biden is the one that put all the mandatory minimum shits in there anyway.
Yes. Yep.
I don't even want to get started on the political rabbit hole here. I'm going off on a whole nother tangent, man. I'm ready for that dude to get out of there. I can tell you that.
Oh, me too.
Yeah, it's this country's going to hell. And it's sad because we have the ability to be a great country. And, you know, I don't know who the specific right guy is, but I can tell you who the wrong one is. And it's him.
Right. I like to see some new blood in there. Yeah. But Biden, if he gets one more term, we're going to be a third world country time he's done.
I have to believe that the American people are sick and tired of having their towns overrun by illegal immigrants, paying exorbitant amounts of money for milk and eggs and the necessities to live. It's almost getting to where before, you know, you went and bought groceries because it was cheaper than going out to eat. Now, sometimes it's cheaper to go out to eat than it is and buy groceries.
It is.
It's almost flipped and everything's more expensive. I mean, you know, and I mean everything from what you would pay at a convenience store to a strip club. I mean, just everything, the price is, you know, almost doubled. And it's just, I can't believe people think that this man has done anything positive for the country in the last 4 years. It would, I just can't see it.
Me either.
So you re-violate, you got to go back. What's your sentence here? 15 years?
Another 15 year sentence. Yes.
other people? Were you at this point just like, shit, here we go again?
Yeah, I actually, this time it bothered me because I didn't see it possible. I didn't think they could actually give me 15 years for just touching a gun. Even with the police officer's permission, it still didn't matter. Mm-hmm. And the judge asked the prosecutor to drop the armed career criminal, but he wouldn't do it because the judge would have gave me probation.
Wow.
That's it.
And I'm assuming you lost all the stuff you said you had, all your toys, how, and all that went away.
Yeah, most of it, but how I had to get rid of everything. My brother Jim in Virginia went to Wisconsin from Colorado and got a U-Haul and got what was left. But by that time, it wasn't much.
Now, they send you to Sandstone Prison in Minnesota. Is your first prison you go to?
Yes.
What is that like?
That wasn't a bad prison, really. The COs there, those Minnesota boys, and most of them just came back from Iraq or Afghanistan and, just starting families now. And they just loved me.
Yeah.
They hated child molesters. A couple of them would let me know when they were coming in.
So they knew your reputation.
Yes.
And you got, over a period of time, I think you said you got around 20 months altogether in the hole here and there for smashing Jomos.
From each prison, yes. Yep. I did 4 to 6 months in each prison in the hole. And then you got to do that, Con Air and all these transfer stuff that was just horrible on your body.
And you said the guards, knowing this, they would kind of, I guess, tell you without telling you or let you kind of do what you did here and so they could have plausible deniability?
Yeah, they couldn't be there when I did anything. They just let me know who it was. And they'd come in and if they came into my section, they have so much money. I feel bad for the parents of these child molesters because they all think it's their fault and they send them money all the time. I never seen a poor child molester. They had so much money. And they come into prison and they buy their new tennis shoes, their new clothes, and a couple $100 in commissary, and then I just take it all.
And what would you do?
I gave it away though. I didn't sell it. I was I just gave it to all the guys that didn't have nothing, the good guys.
When they come in, what do they do? Do they know that they're marked as chobos? Or, are they trying to lie about it? Or are they trying to get protection? What is their mode of thinking here?
They can't really lie about it for long because now they've got the computers in prison.
Right.
When they did state time, of course, there was no computers, wasn't phones even until near the end. So you could just get on the computer law library and look anybody up if they have an appeal. If they have an appeal, you could see what they're in for. So I know every child molester is appealing. So, they might be there a week or two before we figure them out. But a lot of times I say the CO will let us know.
What's lower rank in there, a chomo or a snitch?
Chomo. But they're both in pretty bad, pretty much same category. But, people stay away from the snitches. Right. This is a low security, so not a lot of violence. But if a snitch was in a higher security, he could stab just as fast as a child molester.
Right. Now, how long were you in Sandstone Prison?
About 20 months, and they transferred me out. They had one trauma got hurt really bad, and they figured out who did it, but there's no proof. But they know they got a good media.
Yeah.
So they transfer me out.
And then when they transfer you out, you said you had to go to Oklahoma every time. Was that like a stopping point or something?
Yeah, it's a transfer center. Basically, it's the hole. You're pretty much just locked up until a bus or a plane comes for you.
Okay. And is this similar to the movie Con Air? Do they have you on a cell in a plane or are you just strapped to a seat? What's the situation?
I wish it was like Con Air. I would have been gone. But no, it's secure. They got 6-7 marshals on the plane, and you're cuffed, shackled to your waist. Your legs are cuffed. And after the second prison, after smashing other child molesters, they put you in a, it's called a black box. And it's just a box that goes over your handcuffs and to your belt, and you can't even wiggle.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's bad. Especially if you have to go to the bathroom.
You go to Terre Haute, Indiana here, and this is what, this is a medium prison?
Yes, it was a good prison. And they tried to keep me there because the caseworker said, you're not good in these loads, and your mindset, you're not going to ever do good in these. You need to stay here. I said, I'm with you. And they did what they could in Region, who runs the federal system, because they go by how many points you got. Well, I was out for 21 years, so I had low points. So I was minimum security. And I stayed there, and then they were forced to send me to another prison. They wanted to keep me there. I wanted to stay there. Wow. But then they sent me there.
So at that point, I mean, like, if it's based on points, I mean, if you get in a fight or two and it gets on your record, would that allow you to stay, or would that just, how does that work?
It takes a lot to get up to, I had like 5 points. I think you needed 15 to get to a medium.
Oh, okay. Well, you'd have to beat the hell out of everybody then.
Yeah. You pretty much got to hurt a guard or something serious. I wasn't going to do that.
Yeah. You don't want to mess up that relationship. If you're friendly with the guard, you don't want to upset that apple cart. That'll make things more difficult for you.
Definitely.
Yeah. Now after this, this is kind of where we get into the Fogel situation. You go to Inglewood,
right? Colorado,
Inglewood, Colorado. You don't have a say in these prisons to where you go, do you? They just send you wherever.
Oh, they send you whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and this is a low.
Yes. It just turned from a medium to a low. So there's still a lot of good guys there from the medium that they just let stay there, and they just put their points down for them, even though they weren't supposed to go that, because he kept a lot of them there. So it was pretty decent when I first got there.
Now, you went back in prison. Right, what age were you when you re-violated?
55.
You were 55. So now you're got to be, when you get to Inglewood, you're what, pushing late 50s, early 60s?
I was 57 or 58.
So, okay. And what is this prison like compared to some of the other ones? How did you like Inglewood?
Well, at first I liked it because they had a great, they had a lot of weights. The yard was nice. It was a big yard. Everybody pretty much got along, you know, all the cultures, nobody clashed. There wasn't much racism, nothing. So played poker, a lot of poker. I love playing poker. And we played poker. You know, Mexican, black, whites, everybody got along. Mm-hmm. If you didn't, you just don't get in the game. Then if you're racist, just don't get in the game. Right. So it worked out nice. We go in my cell and have a all night game, poker, and it was great until they started this program, special management. How did it go?
Sex offender management program.
Yes, sex offender management program, and they loaded up buses and just poured them in. And we found out that Jared was on the bus, and they're going to turn it into this, now they got this program, they're going to be sending hundreds of child molesters there. And Jared was one of them. So I went to my car and told the guys that this ain't going to work for me. We can't walk the yard. It's going to be known as a child molesting prison now.
Yeah.
Because of this program. I said, and Jared's here. I said, you guys, if you go up to a medium, you're going to get smashed out, man. You're going to get stuck or whatever, because you stayed in a tromo joint. Mm-hmm. But nobody wanted to do it. Actually, who wants to put in some work here. And none of them wanted to do it because it's a hate crime. They get 5 years. I don't understand why it's a hate crime, but hate crimes are made for people like black people or Jewish people. Right. That's why hate crime was created. And I understood that. And they're not happy either. I asked them, how'd you feel by having these guys in the same, have the same laws and like you guys got now? And they weren't happy about having that hate crime. Because what's a hate crime? Hitting a child molester, that just didn't make sense to me. But
yeah, I don't know if I classify it as a hate crime. I'd say it's a heroic act in my own personal opinion.
I'm with you. That's why the other cultures didn't like that at all. But
what kind of treatment was he getting in prison? Was he getting special treatment?
Well, the first day he got there, they had a woman warden, and she took him around, and I never seen this ever happen in any prison in my life. She actually gave him a tour of the prison and just said, don't you worry, everything's going to be fine here, Jared. And he never called nobody by their first name. The administration doesn't, and we don't call them COs by their name. She called him Jared, but everybody did because he was from his, you know, subway. Yeah. But
and just to reference that really quick for people that may not know who we're talking about, around that period of time, there was a gentleman that really got synonymous with losing weight or a ton of weight from eating certain types of subs from some Subway. He was making a ton of money, and then it got there's a documentary that I actually haven't watched yet. Somebody was telling me about it because I was telling them that I was interviewing you and who you were. And there were, you know, the incident between you two. And I think from what I gathered, he done an interview with a certain reporter and let it slip that he found younger girls attractive. That reporter took that info, I think, to the police. They said it wasn't enough. And she kind of fed him like she was, you know, I guess along with it or into the same thing or okay with it. And he essentially buried himself, and he did go to jail and thankfully got convicted of it. So that is kind of who we're referencing for people that don't know. But like you said, he was getting special tour. I've never heard of anybody getting a tour of a prison they're fixing to spend time.
Never happened.
Was he trying to get protection? You think of like Jared is the guy that you would think this white guy does not want to go to prison. If you was to put a picture up there after you said that phrase, to me, Jared Fogel was the picture that you would have in your mind. If you didn't know him, that is a picture of a guy you would put up there and say, this guy does not want to go to prison. He's not going to fare well. Was he trying to, like, obviously there's not really a whole lot of people you can click up with him because then everybody knew he was with. Was he trying to get protection, or what was his mode here?
Well, he tried to get in the Indian car, ride with the Indians. And they told him no, because he was trying to say he was part Indian. And then they had a small Jewish organization there, and because he's part Jewish, evidently, at least that's what he says. And they told him no. And so he had no choice but to go in the Chomo car. And when he did, he hired a couple of the child molesters as bodyguards, gave him commissary and whatnot. And didn't really work out though.
Yeah. Now you, by now, like you said, you've got a reputation as preceding you. You probably, I'm assuming by the time Jerry gets here, already smashed quite a few. Do you think he knew who you were or what you were about? Do you think he knew this was coming eventually?
I'm sure the other child messages told him, this is the one you got to worry about.
Yeah.
I know they told him that. And, but he didn't know who I was because he never saw me. He was in a different unit than I was. So that's why he lasted that long, because I couldn't get to him.
Okay. So break that down. How, because he wasn't there long, right? Before he was able to get a hold of him. I think they were going to move him again.
He was there just for some weeks, but they weren't going to move him from there.
Okay.
No, they put him there on purpose. They let him go there because he was in that child messing program.
Oh, okay. All right. All right. So how were you able to get your hands on him?
I finally caught him on the athletic field, the yard, and other COs out there. They had a really good crew out there, worked there, and they already knew what I was going to do.
Oh, yeah.
So I just went up to him and said, oh, Jared's here. And he said, let me lock myself in the office. So I gave him time to get out of my way, and he was jogging or walking fast or whatever around a track and listening to music. And he had his guys a little ways away from him, just walking behind him. And so I started jogging, and I came in, ran past him about, I don't know, say 20 yards or something. Then I just turned around, and I just walked real fast right up to him. And by the time I got there, he understood what was happening. And his so-called bodyguards, they were already in the dust, man. You couldn't even see them no more. And then I believe I hit him with the left first. And he went down. I just pulled him up by his shirt and kept punching him. I hit him, I believe, 7 times. And yeah, he was a mess. He just laid there for about 2-3 minutes. And I got out of there. And but they knew. I went back to my cell, and they just come got me. They knew it was me.
Yeah, I knew it was you. He didn't put up any resistance at all. He just took it.
He tried to block more than anything.
Right.
I think one time he was trying to punch me because his shoulder dropped a little bit, like he was going to do something because he was getting up, and I hit him down again. But
saying anything to him?
He kept saying. I got madder because he said, why me? Why me? I'm thinking, you son of a bitch. What do you mean, why you? So I hit him even harder just because I was so angry.
It's crazy how some of these people don't understand. And I listened to some of these interviews. I recently watched that documentary that's been, you know, making waves, where it was interviewing all the kids that worked for Nickelodeon and all the shit that was going on behind there. And you think, God, that's Nickelodeon. It's a network built for kids. You know, you think, God, at least they would protect them. And there was awful things going on there. And then some of these people think that, like, they really didn't do anything wrong. And it's mind boggling.
Yes.
So, I mean, on a scale of 1 to 10, what was the satisfaction rate of being able to, I mean, obviously I know you got satisfaction out of all these guys, but to be able to get one that kind of come in there and maybe thought he was going to have the rule the roost, so to speak. What was the satisfaction rating on that one?
That was, out of the 21 child molesters I whipped on, that was definitely my favorite. It felt so good because out of all of them, he was the most arrogant one.
Yeah.
He came in there thinking he was big deal and, you know, hire a couple of bodyguards. He had some money so he could, and even so-called good guys would go ahead and shake his hand. Hiya, Jared. And anybody in my car did that, got kicked out of the car.
Yeah.
You know, and I think he might have thought he was safe.
Yeah, he definitely wasn't. So what's the aftermath there? Do they come and get him, pick him up? Does he ID you as the assailant or assaulter, or what's next? I know they come and get you for it, but what does he do after that?
Well, they took him to the infirmary, patched him up. He had a couple of black eyes, busted nose, lip, swollen jaw. And I had to mark some of my knuckles, of course. That's where they got me. But he cried like a little girl in the infirmary. COs were telling me they were even embarrassed. So he went, they had to put him in the hole with me. And
with you?
Right. He was 4 cells down.
Oh, okay. All right. I was about to say, I don't know if I'd put him in.
I wish. That would have been nice.
Yeah.
But they let him out the next day. And okay.
You were in there for what, 4 months?
About 4 months, yeah.
All right. Now, when you get out, do they have to move you because of this one, this assault? They move you to another prison then?
Oh, yeah. Every time I got convicted, I'd stay in the hole until he came and got me to transfer me.
Now, we actually have that incident report that we're going to post up here. Try to zoom in so you can read portions of it. I don't know how well it'll come across. But whenever, I mean, essentially, if it gets to a point where you want to move prisons, you find one of these guys to beat on, and it's kind of like a means of travel.
Right.
I guess you got the system worked out. That's free travel.
Yeah, I liked it. I travel more in prison than I ever have out here.
And you go you go back to Arizona, Safford Prison, this is Fed Prison?
Yes. Another damn low.
Another low. So yep. Are all things considered, were you happy to be getting out of that one with all that, all the chomos that were coming in the other one from that salt?
Oh, program? Yes. I had to go out because I wouldn't stay in a prison like that.
Right.
Jerry walking yard. Come on, you guys. I don't know how anybody could do that.
Right. Now you go to Safford Prison. How long were you there for this one?
That prison was there was a lot of child molesters there. I couldn't take it. I was only there 10 months.
You think maybe somebody's putting you in these places for a reason?
A couple of COs told me that's what they're doing to straighten it out.
Really? So, I'm not putting it past them because, like, you know, think what you will about guards. And I know there's bad guards, there's bad prisoners, there's bad people. I mean, it's just the way it is. But I think deep down, there's some guards that maybe have daughters or sons and they know what some of these people do. And if they have a way to get you there to maybe straighten some things out and right some wrongs, I don't put that past them facilitating this to specifically get you to these locations to do a little whipping.
I had a couple of counselors tell me that too, that they think that's what it is because they're getting out of line. There's too many, because there's so many of them. It's the most growing crime is child molesters.
Yeah.
The most growing crime.
How many of them did you get while you were in Safford?
Originally 10 months. I only got two. The second one was, he was a guy who was actually, before I got there, he was in the white car. Because nobody figured them out. I saw him. You could tell. I've been around. I could almost tell somebody was a chomo by looking at them in their face. Looking those dead eyes. And so I had a CO look him up for me. And sure enough, he was a child molester. And nobody wanted to do nothing. And so we undercovered him first. Then, of course, he was out of the car and went with the child molesters. And then I said, I can't have this. Man, this guy was embarrassed us by being in our car to begin with. And he played, he was like the Jared syndrome thing. His dad was named Don Durant. He was in a, Don Durant was a singer, he's been in many TV shows. He had a number one Western called Johnny Ringo in 59 and 60. And his son is Jeff Durant. He's the chomo. And so he's playing off of that because his dad left him millions and millions of dollars, playing off the fame of his dad, you know, kind of like Jared, playing off the fame of Subway, and he had a lot of money. So yeah, I ended up beating the hell out of him. And he ratted me off and, back to the hole.
Now, what age are you here?
Well, when I smashed Jared, I was 60.
Right.
So now I went there. I'm 61 or 62.
Okay. So you're up there, but still, I mean, but you can, anybody that's watching this video can tell you're still in shape, you know, right now. So I can imagine you still stay pretty active in there. Were you avid weightlifter and stuff to keep up?
At the prisons that had them, they had weights. I lifted weights constantly. Otherwise, like most prisoners, like you're in the shoe in the hole, you do burpees and stuff like that. And out here, right now I'm benching 260. I'm 69 in August. I jogged 3 miles the other day, and I'm trying to stay in shape for sure because I'm trying to do these events for the kids we'll talk about later.
If I had to drive 3 miles, I'd probably pass out. Next, you go to Latuna, Texas.
Latuna. Yeah, that wasn't too bad at first, but the same thing. After I'm there a while, I find out who everybody is. Mm-hmm. So I know this is a chomo, and they walk around like they're about something, and this one here, he would tell everybody, nobody's going to touch me because I'll give him 5 years for a hate crime. Well, that set me off right there. So I beat the hell out of him.
How long were you in that one?
I was in 2 years, except for the last 6 months I was in the hole.
For that?
Yeah, for that one.
And so again, you go to the hole, you get out, they transfer you again to Beaumont, Texas.
I like Beaumont. That was a pretty good prison because they don't transfer too many people out of Beaumont. They got a maximum security, medium, low, and a camp.
Okay.
Never made it to the camp, of course, but you got to be no violence on your record for 2 years or something like that. But
I don't think you're going to get there.
No, I knew that right from the start. So I was there for two. They went to what trauma? Oh, I one of the worst traumas I've ever ran across. And the prison itself wasn't too bad. And that was when COVID started.
Right.
So it got really crazy in Beaumont because we got all these medium security prisons there and nobody likes the chomos. I wasn't the only one beating them there.
Right.
It wasn't just me there. My buddy Dusty got one real good on during Beaumont. The COs were scared to come in because of COVID, you know?
Yeah, so they let you finish doing what you got to do.
Yep, we had free reign, and we took advantage of that.
Now, wasn't there a situation here, if I'm not mistaken, where one actually called you out?
Yeah, that was at Beaumont. He was the rep of the Chomo car. And he called me out. We went been in a day room. And I never gave a Chomo that good of a beating. That felt me, and that might have even been better to Jared, the feeling, because I got to hit him like 20, 30 times. And I busted his head on the cement. He was one tough Chomo, though. I got to give him that.
And you said he was like 38, and you're 65-ish right here.
Right. Right.
Age difference, man.
Yeah, but I was a little worried, but not too concerned.
Yeah.
And there was in fact, I was going to get in trouble on this one because I wasn't going to stop beating him. My couple of guys, Dusty and another guy, they pulled me off him finally because I was smashing his head on the cement floor. And I would have kept going to his head, busted like a watermelon.
Is this the one that where you were caught on camera?
No.
Oh, that's
yeah, same joint though.
Okay, so you had that one where that guy was 38, called you out. It's COVID is going on, so the violence is probably available to go on longer because the guards are more reluctant to come in and try to stop it.
True.
And then you have another one. Did this guy call you out too, or it was just one you caught?
No, this is one that I found out what his case was, and he was so sick what he did to some kids. I just I thought he was leaving, going to another. They were moving him out to a different section, but I was wrong. I found out later they were moved. He wasn't going anywhere, but I thought he was, so I couldn't take the chance of letting him go. So right. I had to beat the hell out of him right on camera. So I didn't have a chance on that one.
And you knew it was on camera, but you just didn't give a shit.
Yeah, I wasn't going to let him get by. So, of course, back to the hole.
And that is enough satisfaction that you can carry. You can do your time in the hole to do this. Was it always beat and throw him a good beating, or would it ever have been to the point to where you may have killed him had you had the opportunity?
Well, if I thought I could get away with it, yeah, they would have been gone off this earth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So you go back to the hole. Well, how long are you in there this time?
I think I was there for like 5 months in that one.
No. And then they transfer you to another prison after that.
Yeah. Back to Oklahoma. Then on the bus and the plane. And I ended up in Yazoo, Mississippi.
Yazoo, Mississippi. And you were there for roughly around 18 months.
That's what I got out of. That's the prison that, yeah.
And you said one guy called you. You had a fight in the shower, a pretty physical fight in the shower.
Yeah, this guy was, another one that pretty much called me out. And he was young, like 32, pretty stout guy. And I thought to myself, well, this could turn bad, because if any one of these chomos got the best of me, I would have to stab him.
Right.
And this one, it's the only one that I actually bought my own shank. And the shower room, there's like 5 or 6 showers on each side and a big floor in the middle.
Right.
So that's where everybody went to fight.
Mm-hmm.
So I took him in there, and to make sure, I elbowed him, I kneed him, punched him, and he got some in too now. But then I got my finger and I pushed it. It was under his eyeball. I almost had it popped out. Just another second, he turned the right way, it got out. Otherwise, that eyeball was completely out. And to say, if he would have got the advantage of me, I would have stabbed him to death.
Wow. And did you get any time over that?
Nope. Didn't get caught.
Wow. So when you
didn't get caught for most of them. I only got convicted 4 times. I was put in a shoe 3 or 4 other times, but I beat him.
Yeah, because you sent me a few of the incident reports that you have, one being the one with Jared. So when you would get these guys and would you throw them a beating, would they be reluctant to try to press it any further?
Yeah, they're scared to go to the hole.
Right.
They're scared to death, because one thing I did like about the hole, you had the best prisoners there, because they're all there for fighting or whatever the case may be. You got all the solid guys in there.
Okay.
So I didn't mind going there, because I was hanging out with guys I wanted to be with.
Okay. But theoretically, these guys, like the guy that you talked about, you know, you almost took his eye out. He could have went to a CO and basically snitched and said this guy did this or whatever. But right. Did they not do it?
He didn't. Others did tell him, yeah.
I would think when they know that you've already given them a beating once, that if they do that, it's probably not going to get any better for them.
Right.
So that's probably the mode of thinking, to not do that and worsen the situation, because next time it might be worse than what they got the first time.
Right. Exactly.
So you finished out your time there in Yazoo, Mississippi?
Yes. I got out of there 2023, February 16th.
Now, I want to say it was in March. I heard your story. I found you on Messenger. I hit you up, and you said at that time, you said, I just got out. I'm in a halfway house. Give me a little time and we'll connect. And, right. You know, then I got a little busy. Obviously, you know, everybody has stuff going on. It kind of slipped my mind. Then I seen you on an interview with JD Delay. And I was like, oh, I remember talking to that guy. He's, you know, he must be out now. So I hit you back up. And that's how, you know, this interview came about. You did say something interesting, though. I think somebody has been in prison that long, the first chance they get to get out in any facet, halfway house or whatever, they're going to take. But you said going to the halfway house is probably one of the worst decisions you ever make.
Yeah. If I would have known what the halfway house is like, I would have done all my halfway house time in prison. It was just...
And you can do that? That's a choice?
Yep, that's a choice. You don't have to take a halfway house. But almost everybody, well, everybody does, because they think it's better, because you right. got more freedom and this and that. But at least this one here in Colorado, the federal halfway house, it's just a shambles. Everybody's, you know, I know drugs are rampant, but you know that spice drug?
Yeah, I've heard of it, yeah.
That's the biggest drug in prison, because they can't test you. Yeah. So, and it's a horrible drug. In my car, if you did it and acted up, you're given 1 warning. If you did it again, you got a 30-second beat down. 2 guys on each side with your hands up in the air, and you got beat for 30 seconds. If you did it again, you were off the yard. You had to go. In the halfway house, there's no construction. There's no... Nobody's organized. And I mean, they had EMTs there 2-3 times a week picking people up and who freaked out on that stuff. It was horrible.
What was the worst drug that had a hold of people in your whole, you know, I want to say career, but like time in prison? What was the worst drug that you've seen that really done damage to people?
Well, when I was doing state time, it would be heroin. Heroin was really popular and easy to smuggle in. And in the feds, was that spice.
Yeah.
K2 spice.
Yeah, K2. Not counting anything that you did, what was the worst thing you seen in prison?
Ooh. I seen a guy. You remember that movie Stir Crazy?
Yeah. Gene Wilder, Richard Pryor. Yeah.
Yeah. That was filmed in Arizona State Prison, Florence, when I was there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They were real cool. At the end, they gave everybody a piece of pizza and a soda pop. It was really cool. But all the gangs, Aryan Brotherhood, Mau Mau's, Mexican Mafia, we boycotted. We said, nobody gets in this movie because they're making fun of us or make it look like we got an easy prison. And it was the most violent prison in the USA. So we all stayed out of it. But this guy from the Mexican Mafia, actually three people, if I watch a movie with you, I'll point out three people that are dead because they went in that movie.
Wow.
Yeah, and this one guy, Jesse was his name. He's Mexican Mafia. He was in the movie, and I was in the chow hall. And two Mafia members both stabbed him on each side, and he got his guts and ripped it across. And I never seen anything like that. It looked like a bunch of little snakes or worms. His whole intestines were in his hand. And he took maybe 5 steps. He knew he was dead. Yeah. And he collapsed. And his intestines just spread all over the place. That was crazy.
Yeah, the Mexican mob don't play about movies. I mean, I don't know if you ever got a chance to take a look at that movie, American Me, with Edward James Olmos about LIMA. Like, a lot of people got killed for participating in that movie, for signing off on that movie. I want to say there was 4 to 5 deaths, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Even Olmos himself, from what I heard, had a hit placed on his life for I guess being the star of the movie, if you will. Was there ever any outside of the one guy that you mentioned who had the famous father? Did you ever bump into anybody that was famous in prison outside of Jared? Of course, I don't really consider him famous.
No, I can't say I have really, not in a good way. No actors or nothing like that. No.
Okay. All right. So you get out of the halfway house. You're a free man after, gosh, a total of what? Almost 30 years in prison, or right at 30 years?
Right at 30. Yeah.
What year is this that you're finally free? You're out of the halfway house. You're home. What year is this?
Beginning of February of 24.
February 24. So just a few months ago.
Yep.
Where are you at now, given everything you've been through, all the stories that we've just highlighted in the almost 2 hours we've been talking? Where are you at now, and what do you want to do? Because the message you've told me you want to send, I think, is really impactful and is great, but I want to hear your vision of what you want to do now.
Well, I'm trying to live down a lot of my past. That's why I wanted to get out with you. Everything that happened to me in prison, all the good, all the bad, because I'm starting an organization called Steve's Warrior Children, where I make money for abused children. And I wanted to get this all out there because I don't want to get this organization going and making all this money for the kids, and then somebody finds out, hey, that guy did this in prison, or he was AB, and get the wrong impression of me, or think I was trying to hide something. Because make it all look bad then, like I'm trying to hide from. So I want to get it all in the open. And as I say, this is from the 70s and 80s. And certain things you got to do in prison, even if you don't want to.
Right. You know? It's not necessarily that you're buying into the belief system, but at the end of the day, it's survival.
Yes, exactly it.
Yeah.
Exactly it.
And so, and that's completely understandable, and especially for someone that's, you know, not even, you don't even, I don't think, have to be in prison to be familiar with how the politics in there work. I think TV shows can paint a vivid enough picture. You know, it's going to be very hard for someone to go in and, you know, you hear that phrase, stick to yourself. I'm not going to say there's not prisons out there where you can do that and get away with it. I'm sure there are, but there are certain situations that you were in where that is not possible. And you have to figure out someone or a group or a gang or whatever to get involved with to keep yourself safe. And the difference in that is just kind of like the story that you told earlier about your friend Banzai. You know, your path luckily didn't end the same way his did, because he took a 5-year stint. You still got, even those 5 years, you still had to click up. He wound up doing, is he dead now? Is he doing life? Right.
He pulled his appeal, and I was in contact with him for a while when I got out, and he wanted me to come, and because you get a certain amount of people you could watch you die. And at the end, he said, "You know what, Steve? I'm just tired. I just want to die. I don't want nobody to see me die." So, but I think about Banzai constantly, more than anybody in all these years in prison now. And I met thousands of people. He stays in my mind, one, because I feel bad for the guy.
Right.
You know, I mean, he shouldn't have killed himself, honey. I know that was wrong. But killing the child rape, I agree with that.
Right.
But I could have, just like you said, that could have been me. Could have been on death row, man, and got executed with him. But I was fortunate.
Yeah.
So
it's crazy that you use the word fortunate in a situation, you know, like that, but that's what you were. You know, you were fortunate to beat that case. And, you know, I think if there's ever such a person that you would say, I don't wish incarceration on anybody. You know, I only spent roughly about 2.5 days in jail, and that was enough for me. And this was county jail that I knew I didn't want to go back. It was not a place that I wanted to be. And even on my worst of enemies, I wouldn't wish it on anyone. However, I do think it's someone that I think everyone should probably experience at least once to have an idea of what goes on in there.
Right.
And, you know, then it'll give you a different perspective. And if there was ever a guy that I can say, if he had to be in there that did the things you did, that served out the kind of, to me, it would be street justice that needed to be served, I'm glad it was someone like yourself that at least done that positive stuff in there while he was doing incarcerated. Cause maybe, you know, maybe the beating that you threw some of these guys, maybe that set them straight. Maybe it didn't. Sometimes I don't know if there is setting these people straight.
I don't think there is.
Yeah. If you can do that in good conscience and not think you've done anything wrong, I don't know if a beating will fix you.
Right.
And to me, you should never get out. And that's where I have these issues is, you know, these people will say, well, that's all, and maybe they were, but their first go-to is always what happened to me. So, you know, but still it's up to you. You can stop it. You know what I'm saying? You have the power to not do it.
And right.
How these people do this and then try to play it off. And then some of the times these lenient sentences that they get, I mean, some of them only get 2 or 3 years. And it's
insane. The average promo gets 5 to 7 years. I get 15 years for touching a gun.
Yeah.
Put my hands on a gun. I get 15 years. Okay, I'm not going to bitch about it. I did it. It's over. But somebody who puts their hands on a child inappropriately, 2 years, 5 years, 7 years, that's it?
That's ridiculous. I don't understand it. Yeah, I don't know. Those people should never see the light of day. And hopefully they got numerous beatings like the one that you served to them. And you know, I want to tell you how much I appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your story, because it is important to be transparent, especially if you're going to be associated with something to you know, that will be involving kids, especially ones that have been through a traumatic experience. You want to be transparent of who you were, but that doesn't define who you are. And that's what we got to make sure that people understand. Who you were is not who you are now.
Thank you. I appreciate that so much. And that's exactly true. I'm not like I was in the 70s. And as time went on, just from my story, I think you could see from Arizona prison, where I was pretty wild and violent, then Kansas prison, where I came into my own and had the thing with the kids, make money for the kids, and the violence ending almost, and now, and then the Fed system, it was all, I wasn't in any trouble except for beating child molesters. That's all the trouble I got into.
Now, one thing I got to ask you before we check out of here, where did you get that shirt?
You know, somebody sent me this. somebody sent it to me. They got on my Facebook and saw what I was doing with the kids and organizing. He sent it to me.
That's cool. Yeah, I bet. Did you get a lot of like people put stuff on your books and stuff while you were doing all this? Because your story was getting out there while you were still incarcerated. So did you have a lot of people putting money on your books and stuff in there?
You know, I did after Jared. Because I didn't know, because I was in the hole, but TMZ did a really, really big program on me, and I was all on the news, and everybody, I got money from Canada, Mexico, England, and people sent me books, like over 100 books from Amazon, which is nice, because in this particular hole there, and they didn't have a lot of books. So I left all the books to all the guys, so they appreciated it.
Oh, wow. That's cool. That's awesome.
I got a lot of letters from so many letters from full-grown adults now that have been abused, men and women, and telling me thank you. And, I was overwhelmed by that.
Yeah, I can tell that you seem a little emotional now talking about it. And, you know, to see that those – what you're doing in there, it makes an impact on the outside. And that really, to me, is a true definition of someone that can make an impact and can be life changing for some people just by them writing you them letters. I'm sure that had to, you know, make you feel good that you were making them feel better about themselves, because when that happens to you, you're in a low place and it's really hard to get out.
Yes. Yes.
Well, Steve, I wish you the best on anything that you got your hands in going forward. If there's anything we can do to help spread the word, promote, share on any of our social media platforms, let me know. I know you're kind of having, you know, the runaround getting some things finalized with this, but I'm sure we'll get there. I can see if I can point you in the right direction to help. But I love the idea. I love what you're doing. And I think it's one of those things, almost like wrongful incarceration. You know, I've shared my story with you.
Yes.
One of those things, kind of like molestation, people don't understand the impact of it until it happens to them, and then they get it. And it's one of those things that you won't really understand the full, you know, dramatic change that it has in your life until you're affected by it. And unfortunately, that's, you know, when that happens, you can't go back. And, you know, it's not only the people, the victims that live with it, their families have to live with it. And, you know, it's something that never leaves. So whatever you're doing to try to help combat this, man, you got our support 100%. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your story. I really do appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me. I love doing these podcasts, and yours has been great, because you really got in depth on things. Right. And We need to bring awareness. That's the biggest problem with this, is it's not enough awareness. And your podcast, you got a great following. Thank so just bring awareness to a lot of people. And education is another thing that we need. If the children were educated, there would be very few children getting molested. Mm-hmm. Very few people. I know it's so hard for parents, because you don't want to ruin your child's innocence and tell them about being molested. That's a tough thing for a parent to talk to their child about.
Right.
I mean, but you have to. because it's that bad out there now. You have to sit down and explain this to your child. And if you do, you're going to stop that child from being molested. Because if you make the child truly understand what you're saying, then that little boy or little girl won't be molested.
Yeah.
But if you don't, it's a good chance you're going to get molested.
And like what you said, is you're not really safe, because you look in the news, who do you see getting, you know, caught for doing things like this? You see priests, you see teachers, in some cases, you know, law enforcement, counselors. I mean, it's people that as parents, you put your trust in to look after the well-being, daycare workers. I mean, you put your trust in these people and to look after your children and look after their well-being. And it happens, you know, way, way too much. So I hope that your story will bring awareness and hell, maybe scare the shit out of some of them to you know, never do what they're doing. If they even have these idiotic thoughts in their head. And I knew when we talked, obviously the Fogle story was what led me to you, but I could tell just after a conversation that there was a lot more to the story. And again, I want to tell you how much I appreciate you letting me unpack it here for everybody. And I'm glad you could come on and tell it.
Well, thank you. I hope to, after I get this organization underway, I'm having a hard time, but it's going to get together, and I'm having athletic events coming up, and all the money goes to the children who already donated money to child abuse centers. And I hope after I get organized, maybe you have me back on.
Absolutely. Well, you got an open door, brother, here at Crabman Entertainment. Anytime, you come right on back, anytime at all.
All right. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, my friend. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Hollywood Wade. That was Stephen Nigg. And unfortunately, we are out of time. Tune in next week for an all new episode of Crime and Entertainment. Stephen, we appreciate it, my friend. Show me the guns one time, brother. Show me the guns. Ha, dog. How old are you right now? You say 80?
Huh?
You're 79 right now?
69.
Okay. I don't want to age you anymore than you already have. 69. That is great shape to be 69. Stephen, appreciate you coming by, my brother.
Thank you. Have a good night.
You too, my friend. Well, I hope everybody enjoyed that episode. Steve is a very, very intriguing individual. You know, a lot of, he caught some bad breaks. And I think the way he looked at it, or at least my opinion, I don't want to speak for him, but my opinion is if he had to be in there, he might as well do some good things. And in my opinion, he'd done a lot of good things, 21 of them. In fact, at least I'm sure he did some other stuff, like he was selling the shirts and to help bring awareness. You can tell that Steve's heart is in the right place. He really, like I said, just caught some bad breaks. That's why I never judge people that have done prison, because you don't know the situation. You don't know how the judicial system was at the time. You don't know if they were really trying to stick it to them. And a lot of people that are in there do get egregious sentences that they probably never should have gotten. So, you know, just take a time to listen to the whole story is all I'll say. I hope everybody's listening to all our podcasts. And if you're listening on the YouTube, please like, subscribe, hit that notification bell. That way you get notified every time we drop a video. And of course, we're on all the major audio platforms, folks, Spotify, Apple, Google, Amazon. Please like, rate, review, leave us a comment. We try to get back to all of them and share it. We're on all your social medias, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. Share us on there. That's the easiest way to help build up the show. Doesn't cost you a dime. Really helps out old Hollywood. And that'll do it for today's episode. I'm Hollywood Wade. That was Steve Nigg on Crime and Entertainment.